Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Joshua Douglas, a law professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and host of the podcast Democracy Optimist. His work has appeared in the New York Times, CNN, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and other major media outlets. He's the author of a previous book titled How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Today, we're visiting with Professor Douglas to discuss his latest book, The Court v. the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. Professor Douglas argues that the Supreme Court has fundamentally changed how elections are run in America over the last 50 years, and instead of upholding and strengthening voting rights for all Americans, the court has worked to erode voting rights successfully. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Professor Douglas.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Did I summarize your book correctly?
Yes, it is a somewhat harrowing take on why and how the Supreme Court has really failed to protect the fundamental right to vote, that most important right of our democracy.
Well, your book seems to equate democracy with voting rights, and you ask the question, can we trust the Supreme Court to protect democracy? So it seems to me that the thrust of this question is made when you ask, can we trust the Supreme Court? So let's start with that. Can we trust the Supreme Court?
Well, we used to be able to trust the court, at least in the 1960s, when it issued a series of cases that upheld and protected the fundamental right to vote. And, you know, you noted that I think of democracy with respect to voting rights, and that really comes from the Declaration of Independence, which says a government is legitimate based on the consent of the governed. The consent of the governed. So I think that should include all of us. And the court once did very strongly protect the individual voter in the face of laws that would make it harder to participate. But these days, the court has totally reversed how it's treated the right to vote, how it's treated challenges to hurdles that voters face.
Well, I really want to get into some of that, but you mentioned the Declaration of Independence, and I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the 1857 Supreme Court decision, the Dred Scott case, where in a 7-2 decision, they ruled that the only people who were citizens of the United States were white people, and that black people not only were not citizens of the United States, but Roger Taney, the Chief Justice, went so far in his lengthy ruling to explain that they were never meant to be citizens of the United States, and the Declaration of Independence did not apply to them.
Yeah, of course, we have a very sorry history of what it means to be included in a democracy. Not only the horrible Dred Scott case, you can look at cases from the late 1800s and early 1900s, a case called Giles versus Harris, which says that essentially black people don't have rights to vote, Minor versus Happersett, which said that women don't enjoy the right to vote. And yet we've had constitutional amendments as well as a judicial understanding of the promise of equality within our Constitution. You know, when the Supreme Court protected individual voters in some of those cases from the 1960s, it did so through the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment being one of the post-Civil War amendments that was ratified in response in many ways to the Civil War. So, yes, we have a terrible history of the way in which people were included or not included, I should say. But we had a high water mark where the court finally did seem to recognize the importance of greater inclusion and the importance of equality in the way our democracy operates and imposed strong judicial scrutiny, really carefully looked at laws that created inequalities in our voting processes. But since then, especially in cases, you know, starting in the 1980s, 1990s, and to today, the court has really severely pulled back on that protection.
So in your book, you break down the strategic encroachment on voting rights by the highest court in America through an examination of a series of Supreme Court case rulings. Now, I want to get into an overview of each case by case at some point during our conversation, in order to help us understand how each ruling impacted the electorate. But first, I want to set the stage and go back to 1965 and gain a better understanding of the conditions of voting rights at that time.
Yeah, so obviously this was an era of the great civil rights movement, of the Freedom Summer in Alabama, where people were fighting to break down barriers to registration. And this was in response to a lot of horrible ways that states and localities made it difficult for black people in particular to register to vote or to cast voting rights. You had these tests like tell me how many bubbles there are in a bar of soap to be able to register, but of course only black people were asked that kind of question. You had violence and intimidation. So there was a big push, however, in the face of this to eradicate the Jim Crow era type laws. You had the Great March on Selma, where there was a march between Selma and Montgomery, where they were fighting for voting rights, and the violence there spurred President Lyndon Johnson to advocate for, and eventually Congress passed, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, perhaps one of the most important laws ever enacted in terms of breaking down barriers to participation. And so the context of the courts acting in the 1960s in a way that was stronger, that provided stronger protection for voting rights, was this really social unrest with respect to the attempt to regain, or to not regain, but to gain voting rights, particularly for minority individuals, and this understanding that voting was so important to political equality and to democracy.
And black people were leading that, putting their lives on the line, along with white allies. My guest is Joshua Douglas, a law professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and host of the podcast Democracy Optimist. He is the author of a new book, The Court v. the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. Professor, you asked the question in your book, how did I decide which Supreme Court cases to profile? And that's a smart question. How did you decide?
Yeah, it was difficult because when you're coming up with a list of the cases in which the court has really failed to protect voters, there's many more than the 10 that I profile, or 9 plus I call Chapter 10 the next looming case. I started with the idea that I wanted to have this book be about more modern history, so post-1960. There's certainly a lot of cases pre-1960, like I mentioned a few of them, where the court really failed to protect and undermined equality in voting rights. But we got to a place where the court was recognizing the fundamental right to vote under the U.S. Constitution. So I wanted to start after the 1960s. Of course, any book about the right to vote and the current court had to include some of the cases I call the biggies, the ones that most people have heard of, like Bush v. Gore, that essentially decided the 2000 presidential election, Citizens United, the 2010 case about campaign finance and corporations spending money on campaigns, Shelby County, the 2013 case that gutted the Voting Rights Act. So I had a kind of list of the big ones. But then I also thought, what are the cases that maybe a lot of people don't know about, have never heard of, but have such an important foundation for how the court understands the right to vote? And so that's what I focused on for the remaining slots. I initially had a list of 12 cases. It was 15, then 12, and I cut it down to what was in the book, really focusing on which are the ones that both people have heard of, but maybe don't fully understand the actual story behind them, and then cases that probably no one's heard of, but have a really huge impact on the court's approach today.
And speaking of which, you characterized the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan as, quote, the beginning of the end, end quote. So I was surprised to learn about the extraordinary candidacy of John Anderson and his subsequent litigation that invoked the 14th Amendment. Tell us who John Anderson was and why he's a central character in 1980, despite Reagan's sweeping victory.
Yeah, this is chapter one of the book, so the first case, which is why I refer to it as the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the end of the strong protection for voting rights that the court had adopted. Now, John Anderson was a member of Congress for many years from Rockford, Illinois. I like that fact that he's from Rockford because I'm a big baseball fan, and Rockford's the home of the Rockford Peaches, depicted in the great movie A League of Their Own, the Women's Baseball League. And he was kind of a beloved figure in Rockford. I traced his origin story in the book.
A Republican.
A Republican, yeah, but moderate Republican, but a Republican who actually started out, he was kind of very strongly understood as a strong Republican, and he ran for president, announced his candidacy in 1979 as a Republican to get the Republican nomination for president in 1980. But he kind of quickly saw the writing on the wall that he wasn't going to get the nomination, that Ronald Reagan would get the nomination, and so he decided to run as an independent instead. And so in March of 1980, announced that he was no longer going to run for the Republican nomination, but was going to run as an independent. He had a problem, however, which is that the ballot access deadline for independents, that is, the date by which an independent candidate had to tell the state they were going to be on the ballot, had already passed in five states, including Ohio, which is the case that made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. So he's campaigning, and he actually is doing really well. At one point over the summer, he's polling at about 20 or maybe even 25%. But his lawyers are fighting to get him on the ballot in all 50 states. And again, he had a problem in five states whose ballot access deadlines were early. He eventually does get on the ballot in all 50 states. He doesn't do that great come November, but the case continues on after the election as to, is it constitutional for a state like Ohio to have a very early ballot access deadline, a deadline by which you have to gather your signatures to be able to appear on the ballot in November? And so that is the case that ultimately makes it to the Supreme Court in 1983. That is the decision of the court is what I refer to as the beginning of the end for the protection of voting rights.
Okay, and that's about ballot access. And it applied to third-party candidates only?
Well, third-party or independent candidates, because the nominees of the two major political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, they get their candidate on the ballot automatically. If you are the candidate who gets the nomination at the convention that summer, your name is on the ballot. So let's assume you decide, I'm not going to appear on the primaries for the primaries in Ohio, just for whatever reason. I don't feel like campaigning in Ohio. I just don't want my name on the Republican primary list in Ohio. But you get the nomination from the national convention. Ohio will put your name on the ballot if you're one of the major party candidates. But that's not the case for third-party candidates or independents. They have a much earlier deadline, and the Supreme Court actually struck down that rule. The court said that Ohio's law with the early deadline was unconstitutional, so Anderson won that case. But it's what the court said in getting Anderson to win, in which it started to say, look, no longer are we just going to say we protect the right to vote so strongly. And by the way, this was a voting rights case because it was about Anderson supporters, like voters who wanted to vote for Anderson were the ones who brought suit along with Anderson himself. And the court said that, yes, it violates these individual voters' rights, but also in doing so, it said, however, you know, states have a really good need to run elections, and so we shouldn't meddle too much in how the state administers its election rules. And that was the crack that opened the further case law that pulls back on that strong judicial protection.
Wow. Okay. We're going to have to take a short break, but this is a good cliffhanger. My guest is Joshua Douglas, a law professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and host of the podcast Democracy Optimist. He's the author of a new book, The Court v. The Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. I'm Mike Green. The JX will be right back. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Joshua Douglas, a law professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and host of the podcast Democracy Optimist. He's the author of a new book, The Court v. The Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. We're talking about how the Supreme Court is eroding voting rights over the last 5 decades and what we can do about it. Professor, in your chapter titled A Vote for Donald Duck, I was intrigued by the power exercised by one man who pursued the quest to have a write-in vote on the ballot in Hawaii, a state that prohibited write-in votes. And your brief history of how ballots went from all write-in ballots everywhere across the nation to states prohibiting write-in votes was just absolutely fascinating. But this one-man crusade launched by Alan Burdick ended at the Supreme Court. What happened?
Yeah, this is probably one of my favorite chapters because of the story involved. And this is a good time to mention that this book is really a book of stories. I try to tell the interesting histories of the people involved in the Supreme Court's cases and kind of what actually happened behind the scenes. And Alan Burdick's story is a great example of that. So he was living in Hawaii. He went to vote one day, and he knew he didn't like any of the candidates that would be listed on the ballot for state legislature. So he went to the poll worker and he said, "I want to write in a candidate of my choice instead of choosing someone on the ballot." And the poll worker said to him, "Well, I don't think the machine allows that." And Alan kind of quipped to me when I interviewed him that he didn't know if the poll worker meant that the actual voting machine wouldn't allow the ability to do a write-in vote, or if the political machine that controlled Hawaii elections refused to allow write-in votes so they didn't have dissent in, you know, who the chosen candidates were. But he was not able to write in a candidate because Hawaii law wouldn't allow it, and he thought this was unconstitutional. He thought that, look, this is my right to express myself how I wished, my right to choose the people I think that should lead me. And so he took his case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the Donald Duck thing is also interesting. This is known by election people as the Donald Duck case, because during the oral argument, one of the justices asked his lawyer, "So your client just wants to write in Donald Duck as a protest vote?" And his lawyer said, "Well, yeah, there should be a right to do that." Now, Alan told me he's kind of frustrated by that whole exchange, because he actually would have never written in Donald Duck. He said he thinks write-in voting is very serious. It's a serious outlet for the voters to express displeasure with the nominated candidates. But it became known as this idea that, well, should there be the ability to write in Donald Duck as a protest vote? And the court said no. The court said if a state wants to ban write-in voting, it has every ability to do so. This is what I start to refer to as undue deference to states and to state legislatures in their voting rules. If you combine that Anderson case that we discussed about the candidate, John Anderson, where the court agreed with his argument but said, well, states have some ability to run their elections how they want. And then what the court said in this 1992 case of Burdick, where the court says, you know, we're not going to question Hawaii in its decision to ban write-in voting, you start to see this deference to state election rules, and I think that's very concerning.
So, Professor, you actually did choose 10 cases or 9 cases, and if you could, briefly walk us through. Yeah, I know you put them in your table of contents, and by the way, I love the way you titled each of your chapters. But if you could just walk us through each one and give us a 1 or 2 sentence synopsis.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we've talked about chapters 1 and 2, the Anderson case and the vote for Donald Duck, the Burdick case from 1992. Chapter 3 is titled The Fight Over Voter ID, and it's about a 2008 case called Crawford on voter ID laws, this requirement that many states now have that voters have to show an identification to vote. And here, once again, the court failed to recognize that for some voters, an ID law would really disenfranchise them. Instead, the court credited the state's interest in election integrity, even if the state has no actual evidence that there are fraud problems. The court said, well, there could be, and the state can be concerned enough that it refused to strike down that ID law. Chapter 4 is called The Stigma of Felon Disenfranchisement. I get this question all the time. If the right to vote is a constitutional right under the U.S. Constitution, how is it that states are allowed to disenfranchise individuals with a felony conviction? How is that constitutional? Well, it comes back to this case that I discuss in Chapter 4 called Richardson versus Ramirez from 1974, in which the court upheld California's felon disenfranchisement law. This is another interesting case with a really fascinating story about a guy who got into a bar fight in Texas, served his time, and 20 years later wanted to vote and wasn't able to. And it tells basically why felon disenfranchisement is constitutional. Chapter 5 is entitled Money Talks. It's about Citizens United, that 2010 case in which the court allows corporations to spend money on campaigns. And I see this as much as a campaign finance case as it is a voting rights case, because it means that voters are basically shut out of the ability to have an influence on the political discourse if big corporations and secret, what we call dark money, that you can't figure out who's spending it, is allowed to fill the airwaves or fill the internet. There's only a finite amount of space. Chapter 6 is probably the funniest title, and I took it from another couple of professors who wrote about the Bush v. Gore case. Chapter 6 is titled An Embarrassing Judicial Fart. It's about Bush v. Gore, the case that decided the 2000 presidential election. And I tell some surprising aspects about that case that people don't really know with respect to behind the scenes of it. But I also discuss it in the context of, no election is really over these days because everyone thinks you can have post-election litigation. And in the context of that, again, the courts are deferring to state processes on voting rights. Chapter 7 is called Throwing Away Your Umbrella During a Rainstorm. That comes from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent in the case Shelby County versus Holder. This case involves the Voting Rights Act of 1965, again, one of the most important laws ever passed to protect voters and minority voters. And here the court guts one of the major protections of the Voting Rights Act and says, no, we're going to let states run their elections as they want without this judicial oversight. And Justice Ginsburg says in her dissent, that's like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. Of course, the law, its very success is why we have more equality in voting rights. And unfortunately, what we've seen after that decision is lesser protection for minority voters. Chapter 8 is called An Activist Court. It's about a case from 2021 out of Arizona called Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee. And this is another case involving the Voting Rights Act, a different provision called Section 2. And here, as I write in that chapter, Justice Alito for the majority basically made up the law. He came up with these 5 so-called guideposts that plaintiffs have to satisfy to win a case under the Voting Rights Act. And they're all out of thin air, and they all make it harder for voters to win a case under the Voting Rights Act and easier for states to defend their election rules. Chapter 9 is called Politicians Gone Wild. This is about partisan gerrymandering or the ability of legislators to draw district lines. And of course, when they have no guardrails, they're going to draw lines that help keep themselves and their political parties in power. And it's about what the Supreme Court said in the 2019 case Rucho versus Common Cause, in which the court basically said, we're staying out of this. We're going to let states draw the lines however they wish without judicial oversight. And then Chapter 10 is called The Next Looming Case. I had a hard time with this one because I thought I was going to do just another case. And then I decided, why don't we predict what the court's going to do? The linchpin of this discussion is a case called Moore versus Harper, also known as the Independent State Legislature case, in which the court was faced with this theory that even state Supreme Courts shouldn't be allowed to protect voters. And the court rejected the robust theory of that, but still said, well, if a state Supreme Court goes too far, then we might step in to undo what the state Supreme Court did. So once again, the court is giving itself more power and deferring to state legislatures by taking the judiciary out of the oversight business of election rules. So the connective tissue through all of these chapters, through all of these cases, is that we should trust the politicians. And if you don't like what they're doing, we'll just vote the bums out. I don't know about you, but state politicians are the last people I would trust to create fair voting rules, with apologies to any state politicians listening. But, they're self-interested to create rules that will help keep themselves in power. Instead, we need an independent judiciary, independent-minded oversight of election rules. And vote the bums out doesn't work if the bums are creating rules to help keep themselves in power.
My guest is Joshua Douglas, a law professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and host of the podcast Democracy Optimist. He's the author of a new book, The Court v. the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. Thanks for that rundown. I really appreciate it, and I have a very big question.
All right.
I need you to be patient with me as I set it up. You ready?
I'm ready.
When I read through these cases and the changes in the makeup of the political ideology of justices on the court over the past six decades, I see a clear pattern. From the era of the 1960s, when black protests over voting rights were met with state-sponsored violence, Nixon emerged as the champion of, quote, law and order, end quote, which was a euphemism understood to leverage the power of law enforcement to target black protesters. And in 1968, Nixon received less than half the support of black voters than he received in 1960, when he garnered 32% of black voters in a narrow loss to JFK, who a majority of black voters supported, according to Pew Research. Now, by 1972, Nixon's support among black voters had dwindled to a single digit. And ever since, the Republican Party has struggled to obtain double-digit support among black voters. That voting pattern of an overwhelming majority of black voters opposed to Republican Party candidates, combined with the pattern of Republican Party leaders leveraging the court to erode voting rights, particularly among non-white voting populations, sends a clear message that dates back to the era of black Reconstruction, as W.B. Du Bois described in detail in his book, Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. Du Bois describes an attempt by white radicals in Congress alongside black leaders to transform a whites-only America with a whites-only national citizenry that they inherited following the Civil War into an interracial democracy. Now, your book, Professor, shows a pattern to unravel that progress that was made toward building an interracial democracy in the 21st century for a multicultural, multiracial American population. That pattern is clear to me. How do you see it?
I think that's right. I mean, there's been a constant push and pull toward greater equality and a multiracial democracy, and race being such an important part of the power struggle of America. And, you know, I'm an optimist by nature. As you noted, I have a podcast called Democracy Optimist, and many people have asked me, how can you be optimistic, especially when you wrote a book that is so negative about the state of voting rights and how one of our major institutions has undermined it? And I think the optimism comes from thinking about what's possible. You know, optimism isn't things are great and I think the world is doing so well. It's hope for the future as we seek to achieve that multiracial democracy. So, you know, one of the points of the book is to expose the problems, to show really that it's not something that's happened just in the past 10 years or just since Chief Justice Roberts became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, but to show that this is something that has been embedded in our law, in our legal system, in our society for many decades. And only by understanding it, can we begin to unravel the problem so that we can get closer to that ideal of a multiracial democracy. So I think your account is accurate, but also hopefully incomplete as we continue the struggle for greater equality.
And that's why you and I are talking about it right now. I appreciate the work that you put into this book.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be able to chat with you about it.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. We've run out of time. So thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you. This has been great.
My guest was Joshua Douglas, a law professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and host of the podcast Democracy Optimist. He's the author of a new book, The Court v. the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR.